This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Nicholas Foley was the vice president of public affairs at ISU's Interfraternity Affairs Council when he started a poster campaign educating the importance of consent.
I did just to show support is the biggest thing I think for survivors to see.
Posters included, no does not mean convince me, intoxication does not mean permission, and no means no, Mary Cullen reports. Plus, Eric Stock checks in with the EDC about reorganization efforts and how that is shaping the search for a new executive director. And Mayor Chris Koos of Normal stops by to reflect on a mayoral pay raise, a capital plan, and State Farm insurance. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal has moved ahead on a six-year capital plan and has raised the salary for the mayor and council members in Normal. Joining us to talk about those and other developments is Mayor Chris Koos, and the mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Koos, thanks for your time today.
Looking at my watch, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The council voted to give the mayor a $14,000 pay raise to about $32,000 a year, and council members a $2,000 raise. How extensive is your job? Make the case for this, would you?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The job, you know, when I took the job, the previous mayor, Kent Carricker, warned me. He said it's a part-time job with full-time expectations. And as things have developed in the community and projects that we've taken on, have required me to be out of my business quite a bit more than I thought I would be. The cost of of things that I would normally do on my own, which I don't have time to do, basic housekeeping, yard work, construction work. The days I'm not in my business, you know, I have to accommodate with part-time hires so that we have salespeople in that. There's a lot there. And the job of mayor, when you're in your community, it never ends. If you're out for dinner somewhere, it's not uncommon to be approached and asked questions to define something in the community. So it's a very intensive job.
You make it sound so attractive.
Oh, right.
So why would
everybody's going to want to run?
Why do people run then? It's
a
tough thing.
You know, the thing that I've always said this, that people at the local level need to separate politics from community service. And most of what people are doing on a council and mayor position in communities our size, it's more community service, giving back to the community, trying to make the community you live in a better place, trying to attract new people to your community.
So the raises for the council and mayor don't take effect until new elections are held and the voters have a chance to elect people and weigh in on this pay raise choice. That's a matter of law. Will you seek to run to have an opportunity to be paid that new salary?
Same answer I gave you 2 weeks ago, Charlie. Ask me in 18 months.
Yeah, always alert there. Okay. Mm-hmm. Going back to the general pay rate for a mayor, how does it compare to other mid-sized cities?
It's right in the ballpark with other cities. Champaign at $35,000. I think Peoria is at $28,000 to $30,000. It's within the ballpark. And when we did our comparables for mid-sized cities in central Illinois, Bloomington, Normal, and I think Danville were at the, not Danville, I'm sorry. I can't think of the other city. We're at the bottom.
So is $32,000 a year either too much or too little? Too much for a part-time job, not enough for a full-time job with the skill set and duties required?
Well, I think it offsets expenses that are not easily identifiable to a person running for mayor. I'm certainly not, I could make the argument that it could be a full-time job with a city manager in terms of being an ambassador for your community. That's something I've done, U.S. Conference of Mayors. I've spoken about what we've done at a number of other cities and venues about our successes with our uptown plan and our transportation-oriented development that we've done in the community. So in the sense that a full-time mayor in a council-manager form of government would not be running the city like a city manager would be.
But you would be advocating for the city. It would be working on policy, too.
Exactly.
And making the case for political choices that are the province of an elected official. Are there models where that happens? And would is normal big enough to start thinking that way?
Well, that's a good question, you know, and that's something that we've got to look at going forward. I think the answer to that is yes. You know, I'm no council manager forms of government where the mayor has an equivalent salary. I'm thinking about a community on the East Coast and actually has a full-time assistant to help that person exercise their duties and do what they're supposed to do for their community.
That has to be well defined, though, and it has to carry with it some expectation of expertise as well as the time.
Absolutely.
So how do you write that into an elected position? Since
it's
the
difficult
people get to choose.
Yeah, it's difficult to do. In the sense that if you look at the history of the town of Normal, the mayors and the council members have been actively engaged as long as I can remember. 20, 30 years ago, there were different issues than there are today. But I can't recall a member of the body that didn't work actively to make the city a better place.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us is Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal. The town approved a capital improvement plan stretching over the next 5-6 years last night. 122 capital projects, including Constitution Trail improvements, park renovations, road work, and about $88.3 million over the next 6 annual budgets. Compare this to past plans, would you? What shifts in emphasis did you try to make?
You know, in this plan, I think there's in the next year coming an emphasis on water and sewer upgrades. We do have the funding for that in our water and sewer fund to make improvements that need to be done to ensure that we have quality water throughout the community. I think that's probably the emphasis this year. And that plan will change. I think it's important to say that that's a plan that's updated every year. It's not a plan we do every 6 years. We look at it every year. It's called the Capital Improvement Plan. And if people are interested, it's on the website, www.normal.org. And it's an interactive site where you can select a project and drill down in the detail of it and find out what it is, what it's going to cost, who's in charge of it, and maybe some description on what the actual project is.
As a matter of public education, how does the town plan to pay for these ongoing scheduled improvements and reconstructions?
Well, there's a whole basket of funds for that, Charlie. There's the general fund, there's sewer fund, water fund, there's motor fuel tax dollars, there are grants from the state. State of Illinois is talking about a infrastructure bill or a capital bill. The federal government's starting to talk about an infrastructure bill. So there's a whole basket of funding.
Will it entail large-scale town borrowing?
It should not. We've had a situation where almost everything we do is pay-as-you-go in terms of these kind of capital projects. The ones that I can think of that we bonded for were some significant water upgrades in the early 2000s that needed to be desperately done, and we had low-interest loans from the EPA. And then, of course, the significant infrastructure, roads, sewers, water and undergrounding utilities in the uptown area.
Mm-hmm. Late this week, we're going to have an interview with the representatives from State Farm Insurance to sum up where the company is on its reorganization and redeployment plans. It used to be that with the so-called State Farm mothership being the unchallenged center for this company, the talent pool in Bloomington Normal was very deep. Now, that had a lot of benefits for the community. But let's, in a lot of ways, but let's talk about the people involved in creating community, boards, councils, volunteering, fundraising, cultural arts, etc. With Richardson, Texas, Atlanta, and the Southern Hubs now taking up a significant share of State Farm's upper echelon, can the town do anything to encourage extra involvement of the State Farm workforce in community to offset some of this shift?
I think so. I think there's opportunity with some of the younger people in the community to get them engaged, younger State Farm employees, if you will. The jobs and the commissions and that we recruit people for don't require significant skill sets or specific skill sets. We look at things, we bring people up to speed on that. It really is more of a desire to serve.
How does the town do outreach to look for talent for those service positions?
Well, myself and the council spend a fair amount of time paying attention to that. And when we find somebody that we think is a good fit for a commission or somebody who wants to be actively involved, we'll get their information and put it on file and keep an eye on that. And we recruit. We go out and ask people, and we also get referrals from people that say, hey, this young woman's pretty dynamic and would be a good fit for X commission.
The changed company structure with State Farm also creates a different dynamic for community involvement from the way things used to be done, and potentially jeopardizes that sort of outreach that you've just talked about. It used to be that State Farm would send them out to a regional for a few years and then bring them back here when they're promotable. Back out, back here, rinse and repeat till career peak. But if they're not coming back, if they're going to be in Richardson, Texas, or Phoenix, mm-hmm. or Atlanta, there's less of an incentive to get involved in this place where they start. Than there used to be, because if they're not coming back, they're not going to view this as home. They're going to view it as a way station. Is there anything to be done about that?
I think I disagree with you a little bit on
okay.
that, because I do know people that have left the community and come back. So with headquarters still here, that still happens. Now, it doesn't happen as much as it did 15 years ago, but it does happen. In fact, I know someone who is been sent to Richardson, Texas, and has told me they will likely be back here in 3 to 4 years because they are on that leadership path. So we're not going to see as much of it, but it's still definitely there. And I think it's worth talking about in terms of economic development and community vitality in the United States, it's all about where the talent is. And, that's our concern, is that we're losing talent. And that's why we're working so hard with Illinois State University and trying to get incubator programs and quality of life issues that make younger people want to stay here, because it's an affordable place to live. It's a safe place to live. And if there are good job opportunities, the talent will stay.
Yeah, but even if you have talent, sometimes that's not enough. The idea of agglomeration, clustering as a trend in a lot of industries is decades, maybe even centuries old, from medical to manufacturing, computers in Silicon Valley, biotech finance. There's a natural tendency for businesses to go like to like, to share workforce expertise, to capitalize on scale. Can mid-sized communities, no matter how deep their homegrown resources and no matter how good an asset state there is, like Illinois State University producing and Illinois Wesleyan University producing talent, can they fight that agglomeration trend?
Well, I think they can respond to it. I don't think they can, as you would say, fight in terms of reversing that trend. I don't see that happening in the near future, but I think there's certainly a place for smaller communities, and you're starting to see it as a backlash, where younger people who may not be corporate, or sometimes they are corporate, are moving to places like Denver, Des Moines, Iowa, Buffalo, New York, because the cost of living is reasonable there, and younger people are looking for affordability in terms of cost of living, and they're looking for quality of life. And if they can be mobile with their jobs, they're gonna do that.
Mayor Chris Kuss of the Town of Normal, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Glad to be here.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, presenting Pollinators in the Landscape, a Luther Oaks University lifelong learning series, complimentary for guests 62 or older. Thursday, January 24th, 1:30 to 3:30 at ISU's Alumni Center. RSVP by January 17th. Details at lutheroaks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, an update on the Economic Development Council search for a new director and a new direction. Social fraternities are often in the spotlight, but not always for a good reason. There are stories of hazing, bullying, excessive alcohol consumption, and sexual violence. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with one university student who wanted to change that, and a campus community that embraced his vision to spread the message of consent.
After seeing photos of fraternities at Ohio University hanging banners on their houses, educating on the importance of consent, ISU junior Nicholas Foley says he was inspired. He was the vice president of public affairs at ISU's Inner Fraternity Council at the time and says he decided it was time to take action against the stigma of sexual assault within Greek life organizations.
To show them that, you know, we're in unity. Fraternity life is not about this. We're fraternity men. We're about being proud men, being there for anyone and helping anyone.
ISU has 13 registered IFC fraternities, also known as social fraternities. 10 participated in designing and displaying a banner with a phrase educating the importance of consent. Banners at ISU read, "It is not consent if they're too afraid to say no. No does not mean convince me. Intoxication is not an invitation. No means no," and many more. Foley's plan was a week-long campaign at the beginning of November. Some banners stayed up well past that mark.
I did just to like show support is the biggest thing I think for survivors to see, and it's really inspirational.
It was the first time ISU fraternities banded together in a public display of support for survivors of sexual assault. Nikki Brower is the University Director of Health Promotion and Wellness, which works to educate students on the importance of sexual health through online training modules.
They're wanting to be involved with us, which is great because we want to engage them and working to make a better, like a safer and a more respectful campus.
She says she was happy to see the banners.
It's also kind of a testament, right? They're speaking out against these acts, and that I think is impactful for our students. It's also impactful for those communities, the Greek communities.
Caitlin Dobson is the Senior Specialist of Fraternity and Sorority Life at ISU and advises the university's IFC. She helped fully pull off the campaign.
Sometimes when you see a fraternity house, unfortunately some people may have some negative stereotypes or stigmas, and he thought this would be a really great way to show people that our fraternity men care about the prevention of sexual assault and sexual violence.
Dobson says only a few fraternities did not participate, and it wasn't because they didn't want to. They didn't have houses to hang the banners. Kappa Sigma participated even without a house. Foley says they made a banner to photograph and share on social media. Foley takes the issue of sexual assault personally. He says a fraternity member allegedly raped one of Foley's good friends at ISU last year.
That really, really affected me because this person is like a sister to me and really care for her, and just to see the pain, like, actually in person, what sexual violence does, it's devastating. And like, if that happens to you, like, what do you do? Like, are you shamed? Are you scared of what people are going to think of you?
Foley says he wanted to be that voice of support.
I was so excited to see it. I was like jumping up and down. I was really excited to see my friend see this happen on campus because you know, she's a survivor. She's so strong. I'm so proud of her for all the work that she's done, become, you know, better from that experience.
He posted photos of the banners on the Inner Fraternity Council Instagram account and on his personal Facebook page. 200 people shared Foley's post in 1 week. He raised more than $400 for the national organization Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Services. Former Vice President Joe Biden's National Sexual Assault Awareness Organization, It's On Us, shared one of Foley's photos on their social media account, too.
I've had people personally message me saying, oh, like, thank you. But I'm like, no, it's like, thank you, the survivors. Like, I'm not doing this for self-praise at all. I'm doing it because, you know, women and men both experience sexual violence, and I want them to know that if you come out, like, there's nothing wrong with it. You're not in the wrong. You're a strong, independent person that something bad happened. It's not the end of the line. Like, let's get through and...
Foley says he hopes the support of the IFC and fraternity men on ISU's campus will encourage survivors to speak out.
I'm doing this for you guys, like, for people that don't really think they have a voice and they need a voice, and I'm there, like, my parents taught me to be there for people who need you and, like, put others first and just be there for them.
He calls survivors some of the strongest people we know. After spending nearly 3 years at ISU, Foley says he loves the university. He says he wants to leave it better than he found it.
I personally want people to feel safe here, because that's how I felt all my almost 4 years here, was safety. You know, I feel safe walking through the night, but I'm also a 6'2 male, and I'm pretty big, so people won't mess with me. I just want a more safer campus for everyone, so everyone can enjoy it like I did.
Dobson says fraternity and sorority membership is for life. That means members should represent the values of their organization past graduation.
Fraternities and sororities really exist to make men better men and women better women. And at the end of the day, we need, you know, those students to be the leaders in these areas, specifically with consent and sexual assault prevention. And so for us, it's really just kind of another chance to show the campus community that, you know, fraternity and sorority life is so much more than what people might think and what they may have heard, and unfortunately, sometimes what they may see in the news.
Last week, a former Baylor University fraternity president made national news. Jacob Walter Anderson allegedly raped a woman at a 2016 fraternity party. After convicted of 4 counts of sexual assault, a plea bargain landed Anderson a lesser conviction with 3 years of deferred probation and a $400 fine. ISU fraternity and sorority life specialist Caitlin Dobson recognizes an opening for change. She says being involved in Greek life on campus is a leadership opportunity. She says part of that leadership is being educated on sexual violence and sexual assault. Dobson says all new members to IFC have to complete an online module that talks about sexual assault prevention and alcohol education, a duo she says often falls hand in hand. I'm Mary Cullen.
New fraternity and sorority members also attend bystander empowerment training to learn how to recognize situations where sexual assault or sexual violence might occur and how to take a stand when it does.
Maybe humans are what happens when high intelligence evolves in an animal that also has hands, and dolphins are what happens when more extravagant intelligence evolves in an animal without hands.
Close encounters of the earthly kind.
That was unbelievable.
I was waiting.
Oh, that was so cool.
That's on the next Radio Lab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Mid-Illini Eye Credit Union, providing big city convenience with local friendly service. Member owned and highly involved in the community, Mid-Illini Eye puts people before profits. Mid-Illini Eye Credit Union, where different is better. Details at MidIllinicU.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. What happens to small towns when Walmarts leave? An IPR report just ahead. Rivian Automotive has grabbed many of the headlines on the McLean County economic front over the last year, but the interim CEO of the Bloomington-Normal Economic Development Council, Mike O'Grady, says another major economic policy is quietly humming along quite well. It's been 1 year since McLean County taxing bodies reached agreement on tax incentives for Canada based ag equipment maker Brandt Industries, which took over the former Kongskild Industries plant in rural Hudson. Eric Stock has more.
We're really encouraged. This is a project that I think probably will grow even bigger than what we had imagined. They're ahead of schedule, not only on the investments, but also on their employees that we had set as a target that they needed to meet if they were going to get a tax abatement. So I'm really impressed. They're between 85 and 90 employees, and I think ours was you needed to have 25 that first year. So they've well exceeded that. Production at the site began in July of this year. And they're making a number of things. They're making augers. They're making assembly of grain buggies. And one that we didn't think from our conversations with them would happen very soon. Up in Canada, they make a lot of attachments for John Deere equipment. And they are making here what's called a snow blade. It's a wing on motor graders to, you see sometimes going down the road, pushing that snow back so it, when it drifts, it won't be as deep. And they're making those here now. So
and that was not a part of the original plan?
It was maybe later was the comment we were told. The Simple family or Brandt in Canada have either 27 John Deere commercial equipment dealerships. So the relationship with John Deere and Brandt has been longstanding and good, and they make a lot of attachments, not only for motor graders, but for backhoes and heavy pieces of equipment, a lot of logging type machinery. So
we'd heard initially Brandt was looking to bring up to 500 jobs to McLean County. Are they still looking at that possibility long term?
Yes. Yes.
And how far is long term?
Well, that was a 7-year agreement, and at the end of 7 years, they were going to be at 500 employees. I think that at the rate they're going, they're going to exceed that. They're right now in contract discussions to expand parking. When I was out there 2 weeks ago, I scrambled to find a place to park that I wasn't going to be in the way. So good sign, shows that their numbers are where, you know, exceeding where they need to be, but they're getting ready. If anybody sees equipment out there, it's preparation for additional parking.
Are there factors that have led them to go beyond expectations, or were they simply under-promising and over-delivering?
Maybe the latter. They haven't said, but, you know, if I'm negotiating, I probably would do it that way.
Well, the company had initially said it had planned to spend about $20 million in facility improvements to boost their equipment. How much have they put in so far, and are they on track to reach those benchmarks?
Well, I think they're on track. They've got to design it, and that's what they're doing right now. As you may remember, when they purchased that, they also purchased an additional 25, 28 acres. Part of that to the north goes all the way up to the hard road by the substation to the north. And then they bought the couple of houses that are right along the east side of the current, what was Conskill, now Brandt building. So those eventually will be coming down, and expansion of that building there. And then I'm not sure what goes to the north. I think staging of equipment. One of the things they said they like to do, because agricultural equipment is seasonal, so they like to build up their inventory this time of year in preparation, and then slowly roll the inventory out of storage through the summertime.
Do you know if they plan to make this their U.S. headquarters, as they had said initially?
I don't know that.
And do we know what kind of impact that would actually have?
No, I don't.
Or is that more semantics or presentation?
I don't remember them saying this would be the U.S. headquarters.
Okay.
Your memory may be better than mine.
Looking specifically at the incentives, at the thresholds the brand would have to reach to get the property tax breaks, they had said 50 to 75 full-time employees in the first 2 years, so it sounds like they've already exceeded that. From 2020 to 2022, brand has to meet additional hiring thresholds for the tax abatements. Brandt gets a 50% off in 2023 and 2024 if it has 300 employees. So you sound optimistic that they're on track to reach that.
Yes, I am. I'm very confident, but what I've seen and what they're sharing with me, what they've got in design, that they're gonna be right where we want them to be, probably exceeding what we expected.
Now, of course, there are multiple taxing bodies that were involved in this arrangement. How do you monitor what Brandt is doing, and how do you keep them up to date so that they see that their investment is paying off?
So what the EDC does is, and remember, the abatement is the taxing bodies. They're the ones that own it. But the agreement is that the EDC will monitor and report back. So we've had conversations with Brandt and says, look, we need it in black and white. You need to show us what you purchased. You need to give us payroll so that we can understand how many full-time employees you have. And then we will bring the government bodies together. We'll share that information. In some cases, last year when we did Rivian, we actually gave them a tour so that they could visually see what had been purchased, what was doing. And I think we'll probably do the same thing for Brandt.
One other part of the agreement, they had agreed to donate equipment, student mentoring time, and other community service equal to half of the annual tax break. Are they on track there?
They are. And that's one of the things the EDC had helped them with early on, setting up meetings after this agreement with Heartland and fire department and library. Heartland and Unit 5. How they're going to do that? What's that mean? You know, and for Unit 5, I know they've been meeting with the superintendent of schools, and they have a program in place that is doing so, helping them with some training at the school. Each one of those entities, and I'm not going to remember all of them right now, but I have talked to all of them, and all of them feel confident that they're going to hit their gift in kind that they were making.
What do you think their reaction would be to what's going on at this point?
Well, I think the evidence that they would visually be able to see, you know, most of us who are not in the manufacturing wouldn't know, and if you hadn't been in it before, what do you compare that to? But what we'll do is we'll go down the list of what they've done, what they've accomplished, and then we'll identify that to them. The EDC was in there prior to. We know what was there. So it's our job to monitor, but it's theirs to confirm.
To what extent does Brandt's efforts become a model for how you would try to land other businesses to McLean County?
Well, first of all, I think as we move forward as a community, tax abatements are tough. It's a tough time financially for all of them, particularly our school districts. But I think there's an opportunity here to look at a company like Brandt or Rivian. If you base your abatement on what is done in the future, not what is, you know, what is current. So now, for example, if a school district has abated for $1 million expansion, well, they aren't hurt by that because they've never had that money in their budget. Now, the other thing we have to keep in mind is whatever company comes to town, could it hire enough employees that it is going to impact a school district or the community for those services? So we have to monitor that. But I think it sets the tone for our community that you're going to have to perform. You're going to have to hire the people you said you were going to hire, or you don't get the abatement.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Mike O'Grady, interim CEO of the McLean County Economic Development Council. As we move to other EDC business, it's been 9 months since Kyle Hamm had resigned as CEO, and you've been filling in. Staff has been helping to get everything done. But we understand there's been sort of a reassessment of how the organization is doing its work, and if you can walk us through that and how you plan to prepare yourself for that next CEO to step in.
Sure. Well, the board did hire a company called the Development Consortium, and it was their job to analyze the economic development needs of McLean County community, do a deep dive to understand, are we on the right track? Are we doing the right things? That's going to not only help the board, but it's going to help the next CEO have a direction that will hopefully make him or her very successful in that position.
Are they still in the midst of that work?
Yes.
When do you expect to hear back from them?
I think sometime right after the first of the year.
Do you expect the role of the CEO will change much?
We'll see what the report says.
Obviously, you count Brandt as a success, Rivian as a success, but I know many contacts are made in what you do that we never hear about. You have to lay the groundwork over a period of time. While much of that's done behind the scenes, how do you assess whether what you're doing is working?
Well, it's not to say that we don't have conversations with our community leaders when we are, as you say, doing things kind of quietly or behind the scenes. And many times that's to protect the company that's thinking about coming in here. If they're going to make an investment, if they're thinking about buying property, et cetera, they've got to have a bit of confidentiality about that. But as we have companies that come into the community, one of the things that we as an EDC look for, are these good paying jobs? Our goal is not retail. That's just not what we do, which typically are minimum wage or just slightly above that. Our job is we're looking for good quality of life paying jobs that there's a future for. And that's what we want to offer back to the community. Otherwise, we're probably not going to be interested. Not to say that that retail isn't important, but it's not the direction we go. And that's why Normal and Bloomington both have economic development individuals who really focus on the retail part of economic development.
What prompted the board to want to bring in a consultant to sort of take a deep dive into what the EDC is doing?
I think just making sure it's been, you know, if you look back, we had Marty Vonix, who had been here for about 7 or 8 years. Then we hired another EDC director who was here for 7 months and left. You know, and so in that period of time, you do question yourself, are we doing the right things? Are we headed the right direction? Kyle Hamm was here for 3.5 years and had some really good successes. What's the future? And I think they were just doing their due diligence as a board.
That's Mike O'Grady, the interim CEO of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council, with GLT's Eric Stock. Brandt Industries reportedly paid $2 million for the former Conk's Guild plant. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Two small towns in rural Illinois recently lost their Walmart stores 3 decades after the retail giant came in and pushed out mom-and-pop shops. Now the communities have lost convenience as well as major property and sales tax revenue. Some see it as an opportunity to revitalize Main Street. Others are not so optimistic. For this week's Illinois Issues Report, Daisy Contreras explores what it means when Walmart leaves town.
Were you born in Pena?
Yes, I was born in Pena.
It's a sunny, cold day in December, and I'm walking with 73-year-old Glenn Schneider toward an empty parking lot where a large vacant building now stands.
A year ago, there would have probably been at least 50 cars in that parking lot.
The building housed a Walmart where Schneider worked maintenance for 17 years. Pena is located about 40 miles south of Springfield and was once a bustling community. A century ago, it had large coal-powered greenhouses growing roses, serving as a distribution center for the rest of the country. That's how it got the name City of Roses. But the town has since gone through many changes. The greenhouses shut down and the coal mines closed. Today, the town has a population of 5,700. And 2 months ago, the town took another blow after their 35-year-old Walmart store closed its doors. Schneider says the town is still dealing with the aftermath.
It was just so handy. You could go there, you could buy nuts, bolts, tape, school supplies. They just had a variety of everything in one store.
Pena was not alone. A Walmart in Clinton, another town in central Illinois between Decatur and Bloomington, also suffered the same fate over the summer. Clinton had the smallest Walmart store in the state. Experts say the retail closures are only a symptom of bigger issues taking place in the rural Midwest: declining population, aging baby boomers, and rising poverty rates. Some local town officials, however, see the closures as an opportunity to revitalize their small cities and wean residents off Walmart convenience. When the Walmart moved into Pena in 1983, local businesses could not compete. One glaring example: Pena had 3 independently owned pharmacies in the 80s, but those were forced to close.
And so Walmart really changed the small town landscape, business landscape, Main Street landscape, as it were.
That's Chris Merritt, director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University.
And so now when these stores are, when Walmart's closed shop, there is really a void, if you will, because many of those mom and pop shops that were there 40 and 50 years ago are no longer there. Walmart leaves, and so there's this emptiness.
Pena's mayor, Donald Kroski, says Walmart's decision was abrupt.
The reason they gave me on a phone call was this store did not fit the image of the future Walmarts. I call them the mega Walmarts, the big ones, and that's what they want.
Merritt says he believes retail closures will continue, especially if small rural towns can't keep up with the online shopping trends, forcing brick-and-mortar stores to reevaluate their business strategies. Most, if not all, are competing with Amazon's lucrative model. Merritt says the state needs to tackle issues of population loss and aging residents who have less money to spend after retirement.
It sounds like it's a big, lofty discussion far afield from Walmart, but the issue of small-town Walmart's closing is a symptom of a deeper demographic problem in downstate Illinois.
Walmart did not respond to a request for comment on whether they had future plans to close stores in rural communities. But Pena's mayor says without Walmart as a competitor, this could be an opportunity for his town to return to more independently owned businesses. David Fogg also saw that opportunity. His family operated a Save More pharmacy in town for years. Now he's made a proposal to reopen the business.
And when Walmart came to town, it was too many pharmacies in a small town, and we just we couldn't make it. So we closed up shop and left. And Pena was good to us when we were there before, so we thought we'd come back and try it again.
But Chris Merritt, who studies rural issues, is not as optimistic about a resurgence for small business.
There will come a point where even Dollar General will retreat. The question of retail on Main Street, rural Illinois, is a question about retail trade in a general sense, but it's also about demographics.
Back in Pena, the looming Walmart sign is gone, and the building remains empty. Glenn Schneider, the former Walmart maintenance worker, who also serves as a Pena alderman, says he'll be pushing to help revitalize downtown.
Yeah, we'll survive. I'm not afraid of that.
I'm Daisy Contreras.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington, Indiana-based Heartland Trio takes inspiration from garage rock and elements of groove in rock music. The three members of the jazz combo are currently students at the School of Music at Indiana University. GLT's John Norton caught up with band founder and bassist Hannah Marks via Skype ahead of the group's performance at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night. She says her introduction to playing music had spiritual beginnings.
It sort of happened by accident, but when I was in eighth grade, I ended up joining my church band, and my church band played a casual Saturday night service, and I ended up being in it for 5 years. It was sort of a bluegrass, folky praise band type of thing.
Ah, so I'm guessing Poor Wayfaring Stranger, which you covered on this brand new album called Year One, I'm guessing the song has been part of your life for many years?
Oh, yes. That's probably the song I've been involved with for the longest time. I think it's my favorite song of all time.
Even people that don't know folk music know Poor Wayfaring Stranger, probably.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's a very unique interpretation of the song on the album.
Well,
so,
I wanted to ask you about that. You arranged a very catchy, popular song in a way that's almost unrecognizable.
Right? Yeah.
Why?
Well, I've been playing this song for so long, and the iteration I brought into the trio was sort of closer to what I had done with my church band for a long time. I mean, we played that song like every show for the past year and a half, and it's just been breaking down more and more and more. We're so comfortable with the melody now that we're just kind of improvising around the melody, and it's a lot less structured than it used to be.
What does that do for you as an artist to break something down where it's almost unrecognizable?
You know, I think it's really freeing. We've been working on as a band, you know, some of our things, you know, our songs are pretty highly arranged, but some aren't. And this is one of the few that, you know, we're just trying to create something new every time we play it. And try not to necessarily go back to the same space we've been in before. So I think the album recording actually turned out pretty magical on this one.
Yeah. Hearing the songs and the way they're arranged on the album and the way you produce them, is atonal classical music part of your background as well?
For me, yes. I think we have like a wide range of influences as a group, but I've been learning more and more about it in the past year. I studied a little bit of classical composition on the side this year, and so I'm interested in it. I've only touched the surface.
Is that factoring into your music right now?
My new stuff, yes. I just wrote, this is not on the album, but I just wrote a piece that was almost like a through composed, like atonal punk piece.
Ooh.
With some spoken word and screaming, and that was really influenced by my classical, believe it or not, my classical composition studies this year. So
atonal punk music, I want to hear that.
Yeah. I'll pass it along. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You're listening to the music of the Heartland Trio out of Bloomington, Indiana. The album is called Year One. It's their debut. Founder and bassist Hannah Marks joins us via Skype here on GLT Sound Ideas. You say in your press material that the band adopts elements of garage rock.
That's been a huge influence of mine for the past 10 years, I think. And I think we were just really inspired by the process of garage rock musicians. And just we really wanted to have a band. So we weren't just playing pickup gigs and not rehearsing. I mean, that's sometimes a trap jazz musicians fall into because we're always on the go and you kind of throw music at people. But we really spent a year rehearsing regularly and workshopping music together. So I think that was sort of the garage rock process where we were you know, bringing in scraps and working on songs together as a band.
So you also mentioned that the band is grounded in groove, or at least in a groove background. Now, my idea of groove, at least in a jazz context, starts with Jimmy Smith and Richard Groove Holmes and, you know, can move on to Les McCann or Grant Green or even kind of Ramsey Lewis in some respects, right?
Right.
How do you define groove?
Oh, boy. I think groove is just a feeling, like an unshakable feeling, a solid foundation. As a bass player, I always think of, you know, how can I make everyone feel good? So it's just making the band feel good, making the audience feel good, like you're grounded in something.
Hannah, is this a How Can I Keep From Singing? Is this a church song I'm hearing now?
It is. I grew up in a fairly progressive, a Congregationalist church, United Church of Christ, in Des Moines, Iowa, and attended it from birth to graduation.
We hear from so many black artists, whether they're gospel or R&B or almost anything, how so many black artists get their start in the church, but you don't hear from a lot of white artists who get their grounding, get their start in the church. But you sound like you're one of the exceptions.
Yeah, I mean, I actually was talking to the leader of the church band last night on the phone, and I was just commenting on how playing in church with her really helped me ditch my technique or learn how to adapt my technique to like a different musical setting than jazz. When I came in as an eighth grader, I'd already studied jazz for a year or two, and I was trying to play changes and lots of chromatic things. And I think the guitarist pulled me aside and was like, you can play, you know, don't play as many notes, just be melodic. And so that was really important for me to learn how to take my jazz training. And then how do you apply that to music that just has so much soul in it that, you know, playing with people that might not necessarily have any musical training.
Red Giant Phase is a song from the Heartland Trio here on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with band founder and bassist, double bassist, Hannah Marks. You are a trio, bass, sax, and drums, no piano. What does that allow you to do as instrumentalists?
I think for all of us, we've really had to grow our roles in the band. I think it's a huge challenge to not necessarily sound like we're just three people. I've started singing in the band a little bit to add a different texture. And then we're just always thinking about, like, what textures can we add to this? How do we expand the roles on our instruments? You know, I don't think we're doing anything that hasn't been done before, but just thinking about other chordless trios that have sort of blazed the way, you really have to approach your instrument in a different way.
Another great trio played Night Shop here just a week and a half ago. The Bad Plus was in town, which was a coup for Chris down at Night Shop. I'm guessing the Bad Plus is on your radar?
Absolutely. We had the pleasure of having Dave King come in for a workshop at Indiana University earlier this year. And it was really a pleasure to meet him. And I think the fact that he is playing Night Shop just speaks to the testament that I know Dave in particular grew up in the Twin Cities area, which had a great punk scene. And I know he's been very influenced in DIY culture. And so I think it's amazing that they're still willing to go around the Midwest and play smaller venues. That's hugely inspiring for me. And I think they're another group that has that band, that garage rock personality, where they're working on songs together and really have an incredibly distinct sound.
Well, Hannah Marks, great to talk with you, and congratulations on your debut album, and good luck at Night Shop this week.
Awesome. Thank you, John.
John Norton talking with Hannah Marks of Heartland Trio, which plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas in interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, and John Norton. And thanks to Mayor Chris Koos for dropping by from the town of Normal as well. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLT-FM. Or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.